Welcome to Earth Matters on Gila Members Community Radio, KURU at 89.1 FM, the show that brings you in-depth coverage of local, regional, and national environmental issues. I'm Donna Stevens, the Executive Director of the Upper Gila Watershed Alliance, a local watershed protection nonprofit, and I'm your host for today's program. Today we're going to talk about forest planning. This is the process that's mandated for all the national forests, and it's the National Forest Management Act that says all national forests have to update their current forest plans. So we're also going to talk mostly specifically about the Gila's plan, which came out in 1986 and is in drastic need of an overhaul. Joining me in the studio is Nathan Newcomer, the Gila grassroots organizer for the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance. And Nathan is also one of the co-hosts of Earth Matters. Welcome, Nathan.
Good morning, Donna.
So I wanted to start by talking about the National Forest Management Act, what it is and why it's important.
Sure. Well, the National Forest Management Act is a little known piece of legislation that passed through Congress back in 1972, and it essentially mandated the Forest Service to develop management plans for how our national forests are managed and all the resources of those forests and how they're managed. So the National Forest Management Act being passed in 1972 took them about a decade to actually implement it. In 1982, under the Ronald Reagan administration, was when the first management plan for the Gila National Forest began. And then the document that came out of the 82 plan was 1986. So as you said in the opening, our forest plan for the Gila is basically almost 30 years old. And the National Forest Management Act actually told the Forest Service that they had to update these management plans between 10 and 15 years. So they are well overdue in terms of updating that management plan. And one thing to also note is that since 1982, the Obama administration, when President Obama was elected in 2008, in 2009, he began to do a revision of the National Forest Management Act. And so he directed the Forest Service to hold these collaborative community workshop meetings, and they were held all over the country. They probably had, I don't even know, like 400 or 500 public collaborative meetings across the country. I remember attending them in Albuquerque, and they would have packed rooms with everybody sitting at these little round tables, and you'd have people who were interested in grazing would go sit at that table, and people interested in wilderness would go sit at this table, and endangered species, and so on and so forth. And you would have a collective of community members that represented a whole host of different issues sitting around a table discussing whatever topic it was that was at that table. And then you would have an agency person there taking notes. And so the 2012 National Forest Management Act planning rule really took along this collaborative approach to bringing stakeholders to the table in terms, instead of just having the Forest Service saying, this is the way it is, which it had been basically doing for the last 20, 30 years. And so now we have the National Forest Management Act updated under the Obama administration with this really collaborative community approach. And so we're starting to see that implemented now. The Forest Service had something called early adopters. And these were forests that were selected out of the entire country to implement the National Forest Management Act, the new directives. And the Cibola National Forest here in New Mexico was one of those early adopters. And I can tell you that by participating in the Cibola work, they were very collaborative. They really wanted to hear from the community, get input. And when they started to issue their findings, if you will, from those collaborative meetings, you were seeing things that we said in those findings. So you know it was legitimate. It wasn't just kind of this, oh, we're going to tell you where this is how we're going to do it. Mm-hmm. This is actually how they did it. So that was encouraging to see. And, you know, hopefully we'll see the same thing when the Gila begins its update of the National Forest here in the Gila, beginning this spring, actually, in next month.
I'm a little bit surprised that there were so many people who were interested in getting involved in something that seems, to me at least, a little bit abstract.
Yeah, it's a great point. And it is kind of abstract in a way. When you start to talk about agency politics and policies, not very many people kind of, you know, read those things for bedtime stories because they're really thick and dense, and there's a lot of repetitiveness to these documents. But there were a lot of people from all walks of life that came to these meetings. I think that had to deal mainly with the fact that this is sort of a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. The fact that this is the National Forest Management Act has been updated after 30 years. Mm-hmm. You know, I was two when it first was implemented in 1982, and now I'm 34. And so, you know, in another 30 years, if they try to update it, I'm going to be in my 60s or 70s. And so I think that the fact that it is one of those instances, a moment in time where you can really make a difference in terms of national policy. When we started to organize and educate people about that, I think people really grabbed onto that and gravitated to know that they could actually participate in something that would have a lasting effect.
Well, I think probably when the plan came out in 86, it wasn't like that. It just was kind of a top-down Forest Service, you know, here's the golden tablets that came down from on high, and this is how it is. And I thought I would just take a minute to talk about the Forest Plan and some of the information that's in it. For people who've never had the pleasure of reading this Forest Plan, I happen to have a copy. It's 324 pages long, and I just thought I'd briefly go through a little bit of what some of the topics are that it talks about. I kind of randomly chose Management Area 7A, which is in the Silver City District in the North Boroughs. And one of the first things the plan does is describe this area, where it is, the boundaries, the elevation. It gets pretty specific. The acres of woodland and ponderosa pine and riparian areas. And then there's a management emphasis section, and they talk about how many cords of fuel wood can be sustained per decade and the recreation opportunity spectrum, an acronym that we'll probably get into at some point, and how many areas are semi-primitive motorized, that's more than 41,000 acres, and how many are roaded natural, that's more than 58,000 acres. I'm not even sure exactly what that means, but I'm sure it's all in here. And then they talk about the seven grazing allotments, and this was something that kind of stuck with me, is the plan says, the long-term forage objective is to manage for a livestock-wildlife utilization of 80-20. And I thought, wow, you know, 80% of the forage is supposed to be for livestock and only 20 for wildlife. So I'm really hoping that's something that will change in the new plan, that, you know, we're giving wildlife just a little bit more than domestic livestock.
Yeah. And,
right?
Yeah. And I think that you sort of alluded to this when you before you got into that, talking about the sort of top-down approach in the 86 plan. I think that there's definitely some truth in that. If you read through the 1986 plan, you look at the wild and scenic study for the Gila River and the San Francisco River and other streams in the Gila National Forest, there's no question that the Gila River is wild and scenic. I mean, it is mm-hmm. wild and scenic. It is a beautiful river. But the Forest Service in the 86 plan didn't recommend a single river mile of the Gila River for wild and scenic. And it's like, are you crazy?
Yeah.
You know, how did you even come to that conclusion?
All right.
And you read through their sort of like how they came to that conclusion, and it's not even based on science. It's not based on facts. It's just someone's opinion, basically. They said, well, it's surrounded by the Gila wilderness. It doesn't need it.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, if it had been designated wild and scenic, we wouldn't be having this whole diversion and dam issue. So, yeah, right. I think there was this heavy top-down approach back in the 80s. But I can tell you, looking at the new directives now, that's not going to be the case. And when I've spoken with agency employees at the CBLA and the Gila, they've stressed how they really want to be collaborative this go-round and really be accessible and take as much input as humanly possible. They even went to great lengths in the CBLA to have this online mapping tool, which is great, where people could go online, they could click on a map, go to their mountain range in the CBLA, draw a polygon around a portion of the mountain, and then they could add a photo, they could write notes, they could say whatever they wanted and be like, this is a really beautiful area, or this is a place that has a tons of roads in it, or this is a place that has an abandoned trailer. You know, you could really interact with the agency, and I think that was a huge improvement moving forward with implementing the new National Forest Management Act directives. And like you said, just reading that little snippet from the 86 plan on the Silver City section 7A, I think is what you said, they do cover everything. I mean, they have to go through wood, you know, thinning, grazing, forage numbers, wildlife, riparian. Now climate change is something that's been added in there. Socioeconomic aspects is something new. Endangered species, roadless, wilderness. I mean, it really is all the resources of the National Forest go into a planning document. So that's why it's 300 and some odd pages. And
right.
I suspect that By the time the Gila gets done with this new management plan for the Gila National Forest, it could probably be easily two volumes, you know, totaling over 600 pages plus appendices, you know.
Right. Yeah, I figured it'd be a lot longer than the one from 86. That just seems to be the trend.
Yeah.
Well, one thing I noticed in the current plan, the 86 plan, is that they list all these different things that have to happen, and some of it is very specific, like 7 habitat studies and 5 habitat implementation schedules have to happen per decade. It just seemed to me in reviewing this is that it's kind of an odd mix of very specific and kind of broad and vague.
Yeah.
And so I'm kind of wondering if you think the revised plan will be similar to this, or have you read any of the new forest plans for any of the other forests, like the early adopter forests?
Well, so the early adopter forests, they began implementing in 2012, so they are still in the middle of writing their management plans for those forests. What I can say is that the Cibola National Forest, when they start doing a management plan, they go through something called an assessment phase. And it took the Cibola a year and a half, almost 2 years, to complete their assessment phase. And when the assessment phase came out, that's just essentially an internal look. The agency is looking back at their old management plan and saying, this is what we currently have as our management plan. And now we need to find out, are there, quote unquote, needs for change? And that was where the public was able to provide those needs for change and say, you need to change this, 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 and that. The example you just cited about, you know, the vagueness and very specific, that would be an excellent opportunity for the public to say, well, in the 86 plan, you were really specific on this, but really vague on that. Mm-hmm. And I think you should be more specific where you were vague and maybe less specific where you were. You know, and so those are opportunities for us to address the old management plan and try to guide the agency in the proper direction, if you will, moving forward with, you know, managing the Gila National Forest.
So I understand that the Gila National Forest has recently hired a forest planner who's going to oversee this process. And when I talked to him a few weeks ago, he said that he expected it to take 4 years. Does that sound realistic in terms of what the other forests have done?
I think that's really ambitious. I think it's great when agency employees have like a hard deadline. They say, we're going to get this done in 4 years. My experience, though, has taught me that every time they say that, it's always longer.
Yeah.
Now, maybe they'll get it done in 4 years. Who am I to judge? You know, that'd be great if they could, because that would save a lot of time, a lot of resources, a lot of headache, I'm sure. And I'm sure there's also some incentive at the national level. I'm probably at the U.S. Department of Agriculture said to, you know, district rangers and forest supervisors, if you can get your management plan done in a certain time, you know, you'll maybe get some more money. For other projects and things that you really want to do in the National Forest. So maybe there's an incentive there for them to get it done. I just hope that if they try to get it done in 4 years, that they're not overlooking things
right.
and not, you know, skimping out on the public's involvement and opportunities to participate. Because that's really, because again, we're talking about collaboration and outreach. When a management plan typically takes 5 to 6 to 7 years to put together and they, you know, try to get it done in 4, is the public going to miss out on that? I think that's still up in the air and we'll be, you know, we'll see in the future.
Yeah, that's a really important thing because, I mean, when we look at how travel management was done, I mean, I think there was plenty of public input, but some people were still dissatisfied with that. So it's really important to take their time and really make sure the public's involved. Well, let's talk some more about what's going to go on in the Gila after we come back from this break. Please stay with us. Welcome back to Earth Matters. I'm talking with Nathan Newcomer, the Gila grassroots organizer for the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance, and I'm Donna Stevens from the Upper Gila Watershed Alliance. And we are talking about a fascinating topic today, forest plan revisions. So I'm being a little bit sarcastic, but actually it is an interesting topic and one that people should get involved in. Before the break, Nathan, you were talking about how the National Forest Management Act, or sometimes called NIFMA, was enacted in 1982, which is, you know, it's more than 30 years ago. And now we have new directives or updated directives. And why did we need to update those? What's changed in those 30 years?
Well, they were woefully out of date, first of all. It's worth noting that under President Bill Clinton, he did something called the Roadless Area Conservation Rule, or something called the Roadless Rule, This was a huge nationwide effort where there was public meetings, massive public meetings, massive cooperation with states, tribal governments, counties, conservation groups, ranchers. I mean, the whole kit and caboodle was really involved. And at the end of the roadless rule debate, about 2 years of it, the Forest Service had these 58.5 million acres of national forest was deemed as roadless. And the Clinton administration was trying to update the National Forest Management Act after the roadless rule was put into place. But then President George W. Bush was elected, and he put a halt to all of that stuff. Mm-hmm. And he tried to dismantle the roadless rule and make it like a state thing where only states could like petition to maybe have roadless areas. Some states like Idaho and Colorado did that, but states like New Mexico didn't. And eventually the courts figured it all out and they struck down what Bush was trying to do. So President Bill Clinton was trying to update the National Forest Management Act, you know, 20 years ago, or 15 years ago. And now it's just that when President Obama came into office, he sort of picked the mantle back up and took that task on. So in 2009, that's when the whole collaborative working groups and sessions began across the country to update the National Forest Management Act. Because again, 1982, people weren't talking about climate change. Or maybe they were, but not very many people were paying attention to it.
Right.
So that's one key element that was incorporated in the new planning directives. There were other things like, for example, on a wilderness inventory, the National Forest under the 1982 directives, they had to look at three different criteria for doing a wilderness inventory. They had to check it, see if one, is it available, meaning is it there? Are there roadless lands out there that could be managed for wilderness? Is there a need for wilderness? And then I forget what the third one was, but that has changed drastically in the new planning directives to where now it's just availability. So in the past where the Forest Service could say, well, you've already got the Gila Wilderness here. It doesn't matter that you have this beautiful 100,000 acre roadless area over there in the boroughs. You've got the Gila Wilderness. So there's no need to have more wilderness. So it could just easily check that box and be like moving on to the next step. Mm-hmm. Now the agency can't do that. And there's a whole host of other issues like that that are very similar to where it's sort of streamlined the process in a way. So it's not so easy for the agency to just kind of turn their cheek and be like, well, I've got this sort of out that I can get out of and not have to go do a wilderness inventory, because it says if you've already got wilderness areas and you don't have to look at potential other areas. So that's just one example. And again, climate change. And another thing that was included is something called the socioeconomic aspects, where the agency looks at the benefits of having national public land or the national forest land that's adjacent to local communities. And so here in Silver City in Grant County, you know, everybody loves the Gila Wilderness and the Gila National Forest. A lot of people utilize it. So now they're looking at that data. They're looking at recreational use. They're looking at how many trails are being maintained, what trails aren't being maintained. All that stuff is going to go into the new forest plan as a part of the socioeconomic aspects. And they're looking at money, basically, how local communities spend money around their national forests and around their national public lands. So that's another great new piece that was put into the planning directives is the socioeconomic aspect.
Will that also include information about tourist dollars coming into the community?
It may. Yeah, that is yet to be seen. You know, again, we're still waiting to see how these early adopter forests kind of start to really implement the new planning directives. They've kind of had a first take at it, and they're starting to develop that. But once we'll have to wait until we see a draft environmental impact statement, basically, that will show us what alternatives they picked, and then we can sort of, you know, give a real thorough reading of it and have a better understanding of how they're doing.
Mm-hmm. I would think that's something that's changed in those 30 years since 1982, because a lot of recreation and a lot of forest use, I should say, has really changed from being extractive to being more recreation-based. And so that's, you know, that's a big deal in the last 30 years or so.
Yeah.
So is that why national forests are undertaking forest planning now, because needs have changed and because the plans are so old? I mean, are all the forest plans across the country as old as ours is here in the Gila?
Yeah, most of them are. You had some weird – there was some weird timing where, you know, the Bush administration again was trying to get rid of the roadless rule, and then all the court stuff was happening. And you had some national forests that were updating their management plan. It was, you know, 20 years old, but they were updating their management plan using the 1982 directives. Because even though they knew – new planning directives were coming out in 2012, they were using the 82 directives. And so you have some national forests, like in Arizona, for example, the Tonto, I believe it's the Tonto, or it might be the Apache Sitgraves. It's the Apache Sitgraves National Forest in Arizona. They did their management plan under the old directives. They used some of the new directives, but they kind of got away with doing the old stuff, which is unfortunate. So now that national forest is going to be managed using those old directives and not the new ones. Thankfully, in the Gila, they didn't do that. And so we're going to have hopefully a much better management plan that incorporates all these new elements that we've been talking about.
Sometimes it pays to procrastinate, huh?
Sometimes it does. Delay, delay, delay.
So we were talking a little bit about early adopter forests and how the Cibola National Forest here in New Mexico is one of these. And you talked about how there was an interactive mapping tool that anybody could use. And I'm wondering what we've learned from how the Cibola went through this and how these lessons could be used when we move forward with the Helos plan.
Yeah, I learned a lot working on the Cibola. I did all the initial wilderness inventory in the Cibola National Forest. And that information has yet to be given to the agency yet because we wanted to wait until they actually began formal NEPA or National Environmental Policy Act. When they begin formal NEPA analysis, that's when everything essentially that is said or that is given as input officially goes on the record. Until NEPA begins, it's just sort of like a conversation. You're just sort of sharing information and talking about ideas in the abstract or things that you hope to see done. Once NEPA begins, then everything's on the record. And so the Cibola is just about to start their NEPA analysis. And so we'll submit all that data once that begins. But what we learned in the initial setup was that, again, they really were wanting to listen and to collaborate. When they went through their assessment phase, they issued eventually something called an assessment report. And once the assessment report was issued, people were allowed to comment on it, provide feedback, and then the agency issued another document called the Needs for Change document. And in the Needs for Change document, that's where we saw our input incorporated. And what happens after the Needs for Change document is released and updated with the public's input, that is what drives the creation of the management plan and the environmental impact statement. So we saw a lot of things that we asked for in the Needs for Change document, like talking about wildlife connectivity between Forest Service land, private land, Bureau of Land Management land. You know, that's something that was never in the 1986 plan, talking about wildlife connectivity and wildlife corridors between interagency and even private ownership. You know, that's stuff that people have been doing for the last decade or so on their own and in small little like projects. But now we're starting to see it implemented at a planning level document. And that's huge.
Yeah.
I mean, that's really, you're starting to talk about large scale landscape connectivity management.
That's a big deal.
It's a huge deal. These are just like concepts that a decade ago you would hear Dave Foreman talking about in terms of like rewilding North America and trying to create wildlife linkages from the Mexican border all the way up to Alaska. Well, now you're starting to see that in an actual government document, planning document. So that's really exciting. You know, when you can start to see these ideas that we know we need to be doing, now they're actually starting to happen at an agency level. And it's not just, you know, small nonprofits and small people with these big ideas saying we need to do this. The government's now doing it.
So you've touched on this a little bit, what the actual process is. First, the forests do an assessment.
Right.
What do they assess? Like everything? Or
yeah, it's essentially what they do is they go back, they look at their old management plan, and they say, this is what we've got. And they kind of regurgitate that into an assessment report that says, this is what we had in our old planning document. Now tell us what we need to improve. What are the needs for change?
And they go out to the public and ask that question, you mean?
Yeah, yeah. And so what they did in their assessment phase, the Cibola, and the Gila is going to be doing this too, beginning next month, they had these public meetings where they just sort of said, hey, everybody, we're doing a forest plan revision. This is what it looks like. This is how long it's going to take. Here's the timeline. Here's when you can submit public comments. Here's when you can litigate if you have to or decide to at some point. They're just explaining what it is to you and what they want to receive from you. Again, it's no formal public comments that go on the record. It's just more of like an informational sharing, let's work on this together. This is how it happens. And they did that throughout the Cibola National Forest. And the Gila is going to be doing the same thing. They'll have these, they're calling them community conversations.
They are. And I'll just mention the times of some of these, and then we'll talk about it again a little bit later on. So they're starting on Monday, March 9th, and that's the one in the Kaimato District. And then on Tuesday, March 10th, there's one in Reserve, one in Glenwood. On March 11th, there's one here in Silver City at the Grant County Conference Center, and that one starts at 5 o'clock. They're kind of long. They're 3 hours long.
Yeah.
And then on Thursday, March 12th, there's one in Lake Roberts and also one in Tier C. So this information is all on the Gila National Forest website. You can just go to the Forest Plan Revision, and this is all up there.
Yeah, if you go to the Gila National Forest homepage, it's right on the right-hand side. It says Forest Plan Revision, and
okay. That
has a link directly to all those dates and times and details.
Okay, so these are their first public meetings. So
yeah. For
people who are interested in what's going on in the forest and have a stake in it, this is the place to start. And then, we don't really want to hear people complaining about not being notified like they were
in
travel management. Like, yeah, we're telling you, show up if you want your voice to be heard. And if you don't show up for 3 years, you really don't have much room to complain.
And I just want to stress, too, to our listeners that this is the beginning. This is the very, very beginning of the Gila National Forest starting to update their management plan. So if you go to these meetings, go with an open mind. And don't expect to get everything you want right away, because we're right at the very start. Go with an open ear, listen to what they have to say, and also provide some feedback to them as well. And, you'll have plenty of more opportunities to comment and share your thoughts and make your voices heard.
Yeah, like you were saying a few minutes ago, that during the NEPA process, that's when your comments will be formally included in the record.
Right.
But at this stage, it's just kind of an informal, talking to your neighbors and seeing what they care about in the forest.
Yeah.
I want to talk about what the FACA committee is, another acronym, but maybe we should wait till after our break, because this is kind of a long conversation. So stay with us, please. We'll be right back with Earth Matters after this short break. Welcome back to Earth Matters here on KURU 89.1 FM with Donna Stevens, that's me, your host for today's show. And joining me in the studio in beautiful downtown Silver City is Nathan Newcomer, the Gila grassroots organizer for the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance. We are talking about forest planning nationwide and specifically in the Gila, because, of course, that's what we care about the most. Nathan, I wanted to ask you about FACA. FACA, what that means, what a FACA committee is, and what's its role in the formation of the National Forest Management Act. Getting my acronyms confused here.
I know there's too many to sort through. FACA stands for Federal Advisory Committee Act. It was passed the same year as NIFMA, as the National Forest Management Act, initially in 1972. And it's specific to the Forest Service. The Federal Advisory Committee Act essentially provides for transparency for the agency. So whenever the Forest Service undergoes any kind of big deal, like a forest plan revision or a National Forest Management Act revision, like they just did, the FACA Act, the Federal Advisory Committee Act, ensures that a committee is set up to monitor and to provide input and feedback to the agency. And so what they did for the 2012 National Forest Management Act revisions, a FACA committee was set up, and it was it had 21 members from all over the country, and it had people that represented every single viewpoint you could find. So you had environmentalists on the FACA committee, you had ranchers, you had oil and gas, you had mining, you had timber, you had tribal, you had county government, you had state government. All these various interests were appointed to this committee, and they reviewed the National Forest Management Act directives. When the drafts came out in 2012, they provided their feedback, and then subsequently they would continue to review the new revisions until they were finally approved on January 30th of this year and published in the Federal Register on February 6th of this month. So yeah, the FACA committee provided oversight, transparency, and feedback. And it's sort of like it's a really cool thing to see that we have in our country where, again, the federal government could issue new directives on how to manage national forests, but they're required by law to have a committee that monitors that implementation and mm-hmm. provides feedback to it. So that's what the FACA committee is and was, and that's what they did.
It's kind of like this is what democracy looks like.
Exactly right. It's really encouraging to see that work and to be a part of it. So yeah, exactly.
Well, and it seems to me that if they have all these different stakeholders involved, that there'll be more buy-in for the plan and that people will go, yeah, we had a part in that. That's our plan.
Yeah, I think that's the whole point. And that's, again, why I think it's great to see them approaching it with a collaborative effort, because it really holds them accountable. They say they want to be collaborative. Well, they better be collaborative. If they're not, then, you know, obviously we have grounds to beat them up about it. But
right.
I think that they really are genuine when they say they want to be collaborative moving forward, because the new planning directives sort of mandate that mm-hmm. they be collaborative. So, yeah, it'll be interesting to see. I'm just hopeful that people that come to these meetings and the stakeholders that are involved don't get, you know, overly crazy about this. It's, you know, you can only hope, I can only hope, Donna, just let me hope this once, that people will be reasonable, that they will come with an open mind, an open heart, and be able to have a conversation without yelling, screaming, and being over the top. You know, we're all human beings here. Let's just have a conversation. And I'm sure along the way, we'll find that there are lots of interests that we have in common. If you ask somebody in a room who cares about our national forests, I think just about everybody would raise their hand and say yes. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a great place to start before you start getting into all the nitty gritty. And, you know, building relationships is sort of the most important thing on anything. And I think that coming from a collaborative approach really affords us that opportunity to build relationships strongly.
Yeah, I think so, too. And I've also heard people talk about the so-called zone of agreement. So you're in a room with a bunch of people and you're not going to agree on everything. You might be 180 degrees different on certain things, but we can agree on this. We can agree on A, B, and C, and let's not even get into the rest of it because, I mean, that's irrelevant
right.
here. And so just do the zone of agreement where we can agree, and that's how we move forward. We don't have to be on the same page about every single issue
because right,
that's not going to happen.
Right.
So I wanted to just backtrack for a minute and talk to you some more about how the whole process goes. We've already said it's going to be years long, at least 4 years, probably longer. And we start with an assessment where they look at all these different facets of – they look at the old plan, how things need to change, and write a report about that. And the need for change, I mean, those are just regular words for most of us, but they mean something different here, right? Can you talk about the need for change?
Yeah. So, again, after they've done their assessment report and it's been given to the public for public comment, they then issue a draft needs for change document. And the needs for change document will then be available for public comment. And the public might say there's a need for more special designated areas, or there's a need for more botanical areas, or there's a need for more wildlife areas, or there's a need for better quality riparian habitat. Or and the list can go on and on and on. Really, mm-hmm. anything that you can think of, you can ask for, and if it's a logical thing and it makes sense, the chances of it being incorporated in the needs for change document are pretty good, especially if you have like science to back it up and you're not just saying, you know, it's something silly that it needs to change mm-hmm. so I can drive my ATV everywhere.
Right.
You know, it's not going to happen because travel management's done. But if it's backed up by science and it actually serves a purpose and would benefit the resources of the national forest, then there's no reason why the needs for change couldn't be incorporated into that document. Now, once the needs for change document comes out and is commented on by the public, then is renewed with those comments in it, they'll have a final needs for change document, and that, again, will guide the agency into how they will begin to create their environmental impact statement. And will guide them in terms of how they craft their management plan and the various alternatives that they will have in that draft environmental impact statement, which will then again be open to the public for public comment once that draft comes out. Very similar to how travel management happened, where there was a draft EIS, environmental impact statement, public comments, and then a final eventually will come out down the road.
So the need for change, those are changes since the last forest plan came out.
Correct.
Okay. And so just to reiterate, the places where the public can plug in, I mean, we're already plugging in informally in these meetings that are happening in the next couple of weeks.
Yeah.
And then people can comment on the assessment report and then on the need for change report.
Yes.
And what's the next public participation point?
Right after the needs for change document, they do something called scoping.
Okay.
It's a weird word when you think of scoping, like you're scoping something out. I guess it kind of makes sense. Scoping is the official formal beginning of the NEPA process.
Okay.
And if you want to be on the record, you truly want to get involved during scoping. Scoping mm-hmm. typically lasts about 3 months, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when they're officially, like, everything that you submit or anybody submits goes onto the record and is officially a part of the legal record of the document.
And they also address your concerns in writing, isn't that right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, you could say whatever you want to say, I want this road closed or this riparian area needs to be protected. And they have to answer that. They have to address each of your concerns.
Yeah. And the more specific you are, they call them substantive comments.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So if you just send in a generic comment during scoping, like protect all the national forest or open up every road for ATV use, that's not specific.
Right.
That's just a really vague generalization. And the agency will have to respond to that, but they're not going to have to respond to it as much as if you said something really specifically about the San Francisco River is a recommended wilderness study area and has all these great, wonderful values. It has roadlessness, naturalness, opportunities for solitude, and primitive forms of recreation. Here's some pictures to demonstrate that. Here's some GPS files that actually prove it. That is substantive. That's a substantive mm-hmm. comment that they have to also respond to, but they have to respond to in a manner that really answers your points or addresses your points in the sense that they agree with you or they disagree with you and why.
Right. Yeah. So they'll do a draft environmental impact statement or EIS. They'll do a final EIS. And then I also understand that the next stage, correct me if I'm wrong, is monitoring. So implementation and monitoring. So they'll implement their plan and then what? They'll monitor it to see if it's working.
Yeah.
And if it isn't, then what?
That's the idea.
Oh, okay.
If it's not working, then they can do things called supplements.
Okay.
So a supplement to an environmental impact statement. You see that a lot with the Bureau of Land Management. For example, in Las Cruces, the BLM based out of Las Cruces is doing something called a tri-county management plan for Doniana, Sierra, and Otero counties. In their draft EIS, they didn't include a wilderness inventory. And we were like, you can't do that. You have to do a wilderness inventory. And so instead of redoing the entire tri-county management plan, they're doing a supplement that will sort of be like tacked on to the final tri-county management plan when it comes out.
All right, that's good. So we won't be stuck with an insufficient plan for the next 30 years.
No. Especially if you have like a legal argument that's legitimate, then of course they have to do it. They can't just like not do something that they're required by law to do.
Right. Okay. So I want to switch gears just a little bit now and start talking about some of the issues. And one that I know is really near and dear to your heart as a wilderness guy working for the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance is wilderness. So you talked a little bit about wilderness inventories. Can you talk about that some more, Nathan?
Yeah, sure. So this was really great to see in the new NIFMA directives, National Forest Management Act directives. As I said, the previous directives had all these sort of like loopholes that agency staff could use to sort of get out of doing a wilderness inventory. Now, it's called Chapter 70 of the National Forest Management Act is the wilderness inventory chapter. And it says in the very beginning that the first thing you have to do is see if wilderness quality lands are available. Meaning, are they there? Do you have potentially eligible lands for wilderness in the district? And they have very specific guidelines for how you assess whether or not you do have wilderness quality lands available in the district. And it's very similar to the Wilderness Act of 1964, where it says, number one, check to see its size. Is it 5,000 contiguous acres or of sufficient size that it can be managed for its wilderness quality? After you've identified size, then you go to naturalness. And I've been asked, you know, well, what's naturalness mean? Well, it quotes the Wilderness Act, an area that appears predominantly natural, ruled by the forces of nature, and where humans' impacts are substantially unnoticeable. that defines naturalness in the Wilderness Act, and so that's what naturalness is in Chapter 70 of the Wilderness Inventory for the National Forest Management Act. After naturalness, then you look for opportunities for solitude and or primitive forms of recreation. It doesn't have to be both. You can have both, but it doesn't have to be both of them. And it doesn't have to be on every single acre within a potential unit. So after you've figured out size, naturalness, solitude, primitive forms of recreation, then you're looking at manageability from the perspective of an agency person. How would you manage this potential wilderness area? Are there like easily definable boundaries from a road or a fence line or something like that? And after you've done that inventory, then you have all of these potential wilderness areas. Again, the agency cannot designate wilderness. They will never be able to designate wilderness unless mm-hmm. Congress gives them the authority to do so, which I can't imagine would ever happen. So the agency is just looking to see what potential there is in the national forest. And so once they've done that initial inventory, they then would go through a public comment period where people would be able to comment on their draft maps, draft areas. People would submit their comments, and then they would come back and evaluate further which areas they would want to carry into the next stage of development, which would be the draft environmental impact statement and the draft alternatives.
So it's a really long-term process to designate additional wilderness.
Well, yeah. And again, it would take – you'd have to get the agency to recommend areas for wilderness, and then still Congress would have to draft legislation and pass it through the full House of Congress and then have to be signed by the president mm-hmm. for it to officially become wilderness. But it just – it serves as a recommendation to Congress to say – especially if you work with citizens and local community and they say, we've identified these areas and we believe that they fit this criteria that you've outlined in the National Forest Management Act, that holds a lot of weight at a congressional level.
So wilderness inventories are being done by volunteers. Is that right?
Yes. You've done them too, Donna. Don't be so modest.
It was just an excuse for a hike.
Exactly. It's a great – I love when volunteers come to me and they're like, I love doing this because I get to go hiking – and I'm making a difference. And we've got a small little army of people here in Silver and in Grant County who have come together, and we're going to be doing a great little event in April in the northern half of the National Forest. So, yeah, it's really been a lot of fun, and we've got a lot more work to do.
Well, let's talk about that some more after we come back from a break. Please stay with us. Welcome back to Earth Matters on KURU 89.1 FM. I'm Donna Stevens, the Executive Director of the Upper Gila Watershed Alliance and your host for today's program. Joining me in the studio is Nathan Newcomer, Gila grassroots organizer for the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance. And we are talking about forest planning, which is the next big thing in the forest. So before the break, we were talking about wilderness inventory, how volunteers are doing this. And I want to ask you, Nathan, if anybody out there is inspired to get involved, how do they do that?
Send me an email. My email address is Nathan, N-A-T-H-A-N, at nmwild.org. Again, that's Nathan at nmwild.org. Or, you know, grab me on the street. I'm definitely around town, especially now that it's kind of warming up, so maybe I'll be out in the woods more often. But, yeah, get a hold of Donna Stevens, get a hold of Allison Civic, get a hold of anybody that knows who I am, and be happy to get you involved because, there's so much to do. Last field season, we had a total of 50 volunteers that participated in inventory, and we documented more than 250,000 acres, hiked over 500 miles, and inventoried approximately 100 river miles for wild and scenic inventory. That's something else we could talk about, too.
And you still have more inventorying to do, even
Loads.
After those? Yeah,
Loads.
I guess it's a big forest out there, huh?
Yeah, the National Forest is 3.3 million acres in size.
Right.
And 750,000 acres of it, maybe a little bit more, is wilderness. The rest is, 2 million acres of national forest to look at. Now, obviously, not all of that is going to be eligible for wilderness because mm-hmm. there's just so many roads out there. But there are some core areas that certainly need to be looked at, and we'll be doing that this year and into next year, too.
And so you train people and tell them what to look for and that sort of thing.
Yeah, it's pretty straightforward. Again, like as we talked about in Chapter 70, the Wilderness Inventory Criteria, you're looking at naturalness, roadlessness, Are you experiencing solitude? Did you see some wildlife? Could you see somebody backpacking here? Could you see somebody horseback riding? Could you see somebody hunting, fishing, kayaking, canoeing? All those things are kind of things that you're thinking about. And yeah, we've got a little sort of like cheat sheet on how to understand Chapter 70, how to operate the tablets that we use. And and sometimes some people might find that a little daunting, but sometimes we get like little groups and little teams of people together where one person may not be comfortable using a mobile GIS tablet, but they know their birds, or they know their moths, or their butterflies, or they know their plants. And so it's great to get like two or three or four or five people together to go as a team to go do an inventory for a day or a weekend.
So you mentioned wild and scenic inventories and how the Gila certainly qualifies as wild and scenic. So what are the different – I know there's some different categories of wild and scenic, and I also wanted to ask, what extra protections does wild and scenic designation give to a river? I mean, what's the point of being called wild and scenic?
So yeah, there are again, we should also note that the Forest Service cannot designate a river segment as wild and scenic. They can only recommend it. Only Congress can pass a law to designate a river segment wild and scenic, but there are several classifications for a wild and scenic river. There's wild, there's scenic, and then there's recreational. So you can have, say, the Gila River from the Gila Cliff Dwellings all the way down to the Gila Middle Box or the Gila Lower Box even. And you could say, well, inside the wilderness, the Gila River is wild and scenic, but we're not going to make it recreational. Because when you add recreational to a wild and scenic river, that sort of implies like motorized boats, things like that. Like that, that type of recreation, not just, you know, kayaking or canoeing. It's more of like a developed recreation with motorboats and, you know, whatever. And so you could have the segment within the wilderness be designated wild and scenic, and then maybe from Turkey Creek to Mogollon Box, you can make it scenic only or scenic and recreational. You kind of have this leeway where you can make different river segments, they call them, different classifications to fit the needs of the user, if you will, or of the actual river itself.
Okay. So I wanted to turn in the last 10 minutes or so to some of the other issues that will be addressed in the forest plan. And we definitely have concerns other than just what we've talked about. For instance, fire, wildfires. Will the forest plan talk about some kind of a let burn policy in certain areas or in the wildland-urban interface, affectionately known as WUI? Do you think those types of things will be covered?
I certainly do. And, you know, to answer your question on whether or not they're going to allow like for a let burn policy, who knows? That's kind of the fun part here, is that once the agency comes out with their assessment report and their draft needs for change document, we're going to see what they're thinking and what direction they're going to be going. And that's going to be a great opportunity for the public to say their piece and be like, maybe we should have a let burn policy on certain classifications or whatever. I mean, that's where the public has a tremendous opportunity to help influence the management of the Gila National Forest for the next two decades. That's what we're talking about here. So this is big deal stuff. I would imagine there'll be stuff on fire. There's definitely going to be stuff on grazing. There's definitely going to be stuff on thinning and wood cutting and harvesting, riparian habitat, endangered species, special designations, as we've alluded to earlier. And it's all under this umbrella that I really wish I had said this earlier, but the new National Forest Management Act directives are heavily based on best available science.
Okay.
That's a huge change from the 1982 planning directive. They made science a number one priority in making decisions on all of these issues that we've been talking about. It's based on the best available science, and that's how they have to proceed. And if they aren't using the best available science, then that gives, again, the public an opportunity to leverage that and be like, well, wait a minute, that study that you cited is from 2002. Here's one that was just released from wherever, from 2014. And that's the kind of information that we're going to want and that the public's going to need to be looking for to give to the agency moving forward on all these issues.
So I want to go back to grazing. You mentioned several issues just now. Grazing, one of the things that we've been concerned about is voluntary grazing buyouts, where a grazing permittee decides to get out of the business, essentially, and they I know that there's one group in New Mexico that's working on this issue, Wild Earth Guardians, and they've done a couple of buyouts in the Gila National Forest where the grazing permittee voluntarily agrees to sell their grazing allotment, and they get this lump sum of money, which is pretty sweet,
right.
And then their allotment is retired. But it's my understanding that so far those are just temporary retirements, and they aren't permanent.
Right.
Is that right?
That's correct.
So maybe that's something that could be addressed in the forest plan to let – you know, there's some allotments out there that are really tough to make a living on. They're really steep. They're really remote. There isn't very much good forage for cattle. And so, I mean, why not get some money and just retire?
You know, I don't know if they would – if they could do that in a planning document.
Okay.
They might be able to. I don't know. It seems like that's a little – outside the scope of things, if you will.
Hmm.
The agencies are always looking at the scope,
like right.
scope of whatever they're doing. And that may be, that kind of idea might be outside the scope of a environmental impact statement because it's a little too specific.
Okay.
This is a governing document sort of like that would say how to deal with an issue like that, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not 100% sure on that, but that's what it sounds like to me.
Well, that's one of those things we could talk about in these community conversations.
Exactly.
One thing that I know we've talked about at other times are roads in the forest. And as anybody who's been paying attention to travel management knows, a bunch of roads have been designated open and some have been designated closed under the travel management rule. But even closed roads are still out there on the ground. Some of them, I mean, some of them are already grown over because no one's using them. But some of them are still on the ground. And so that's one thing that could be addressed, I think, is decommissioning or obliterating some of these roads and letting them, you know, helping them to get back to a natural state. Is that something that would be covered in forest planning?
The decommissioning of roads is a separate issue.
Okay.
Unfortunately, I wish it wasn't. But yeah, so the Forest Service did the travel management plan. Now they're going to be doing the forest-wide management plan. The decommissioning, the identifying of roads for decommissioning and obliteration, as you mentioned, is a completely separate issue.
Hmm.
And it's my understanding that the agency has to identify, that's an important word, that they have to identify the roads that they want to decommission by the end of 2015, fiscal year 2015. So that's this year, end of September, they have to do that. That's the last I heard of it, and that was I haven't heard anything since. And in conversations with them, they haven't said anything that they're doing that yet. But my understanding is that by the fiscal year of 2015, by the end of it, they have to at least identify the areas for decommissioning. The reason why they have it separate is because it's a whole other NEPA process where they have to allocate money.
Okay.
Anytime they're allocating funds for projects like decommissioning roads, they have to give an analysis of what would be the benefits of going in there with a bulldozer and actually really obliterating it, or just letting nature take care of it, or finding some other way to decommission the road. And so they have to analyze that, put a cost assessment to each, you know, potential, and then propose that for action.
So you also mentioned riparian habitat. Would that be something like the Forest Service would identify areas that need to be protected or improved and maybe get roads out of those areas?
Yeah, sure. I mean, those are all possibilities. That all comes down to the assessment report and the needs for change document and what the public provides.
Mm-hmm.
If the public starts to send in legitimate, you know, examples of why we need to protect riparian areas, save a 400-yard buffer on either side of the stream. I don't know. You know, it could be whatever you want to protect against erosion or sedimentation from roads, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Then that I don't see why that couldn't be a part of the upcoming management plan.
And what about threatened and endangered species? You talked about that really briefly.
Yeah, they definitely will have to have sections in there talking about Lowch minnows, spike dace. Mexican gray wolves will probably be a part of this as well. There will be sections on each of these that will be all lengthy and have various, you know, different alternatives to pick from once the draft is available.
And then we just have a couple of minutes here. Can you talk really briefly about special designations? These would be some more acronyms here.
Yeah, so an SMA or special designation, special management areas as they call them, in addition to recommended wilderness or recommended wild and scenic, the agency can recommend an area for really any kind of value that it may possess. Say there's a remarkably culturally rich historical area. They could make a special management area for a cultural area or for a historical site, although typically they don't try to broadcast that type of information because it's really sensitive data. But the point is that they can designate special management areas for cool geological cliffs or a botanical, unique botanical area, or like I think I even said this earlier, maybe there's a specific species that's living in this one spot because it's really moist and those butterflies like that one wet spot. So you can make that a botanical area or whatever. So those are other opportunities for the public to, again, provide information and data to the agency to help guide them towards the best management practices for the next two decades managing the Gila.
Okay, well, I think that's about it for today. I just wanted to mention one more time when these community meetings are happening. They start on Monday, March 9th, and they go through Thursday, March 12th. And there's one meeting in each of the ranger districts in the Gila. So go to the website to find out when they're happening. Thank you so much, Nathan, for talking about forest planning today. Thanks to our audio engineer and Kuru Guru, Kyle Johnson. And thank you to you, our listeners, for tuning into this week's program. You can always go to the website to hear more.